We're talking with Dr. Roger Lear about this weird Turkish UFO video, but also about alien implants. He's taken 17 strange objects out of the bodies of alleged abductees. When we come back, we'll ask him about the analysis of those objects, and then we'll take your calls and questions. Stay with us. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Roger Lear, before we go any further and open up the phone lines, I want to give you a chance to plug an upcoming appearance you have with a group called CERO, Close Encounters Research Organization. Do you remember what the date is on that?
Be more than happy to do that.
Sure.
We have a meeting coming up in Thousand Oaks, California in May the 22nd. Our guest will be Jaime Maussan from Mexico. And we expect a large crowd of people. Now, amongst videos that he will be showing, most probably are going to contain some of the Cumbergus pictures. So if people are interested in that particular subject, that will be included in the program. But he's got, you know, UFO pictures again from all over the world, and Jaime is a very good photographer and investigator, as a whole crew and a team. So that's Thousand Oaks, California, May the 22nd, and that's at the Thousand Oaks Inn. There's, if they want to go on the website, it's the CERO, C-E-R-O, International, .com, CERO, C-E-R-O, international.com. All the information is on the website. Of course, if it's okay, I'll just mention my website.
Sure.
Which is Alien, A-L-I-E-N, Scalpel, S-C-A-L-P-E-L.com, alienscalpel.com. And as long as we're talking about that kind of thing, I got a new book coming out, George, in about 2 months. And it's going to detail all the pure scientific detail of what's in the what we found in the implants so far, and some interesting comments by Dr. Robert Kuntz, who's been on Coast several times, one of the leading nuclear physicists in the world, who's going to make some comments. And we hope that Edgar Mitchell is going to be writing the foreword. I can't give the name of the book out because it's a secret.
Well, tell me this, without giving away too much. I mean, you have talked about this publicly before. You said you had 17 objects that you've taken out of people and have analyzed. Do you still have pieces or parts of all 17?
No, oh, I love the way you ask questions. Yes, I get that asked quite often. Do you have these, or are they all gone? No, we have almost little bits and pieces of most of them now, because when there's some new tests that come out, we try and go back and test the old ones to see if they start showing the things that we found in the later ones. So yeah, I have a piece of almost everything.
Obviously our technology has changed since you started this. So it's a two-part question. Because of our technology changing, do you have a better understanding of what these things are? And the second part of the question is, has their technology changed? If these things are implanted by someone else, have these objects evolved over time?
No, I wouldn't say that they've evolved. We have 7 or 8 of them that if you laid them out on surgical sponges, you wouldn't be able to tell one from the other. They're almost exactly the same. Now, we have a few that are different shapes. We divided them in 3 categories. One, those that are metallurgical, and the metal amounts are wrapped in this very tight ceramic-like organic coating. Then we have 3 that are little ceramic white bulbs, that I only say ceramic so that I can use that as an adjective to describe them. They're about the size of a BB. Then we have one that's totally biological that we removed. It had no metallic in it whatsoever, and we were only able to go so far with the analysis of that object because, unfortunately, it dissolved in the solution that we had it in, which is the patient's own blood serum. But the metallic one seemed to be as happy as clams, you know, so we've never lost any. We can still go ahead and do analysis on the dissolved object, but, you know, it all takes money, and our 501c3 research organization is dependent upon outside funding and grants, and I got to get another plug in for Robert Bigelow, because he's been very generous along those lines, and a lot of the work that we've done is because he put up the funds to do it.
Give me a nutshell answer to this, though. What is the evidence show about these things being manufactured objects, some sort of tracking devices or whatever?
Well, let's look at the structure in itself. The main metallic material that we find is meteoric iron. Now, how does meteoric iron differ from regular iron? Well, it's due to the amount of nickel in ratio to the amount of iron. It's saying there's a nickel-iron ratio, and there's a certain number of meteorites who are in a category of nickel-iron meteorites. Well, it's exactly the same ratio as a nickel-iron meteorite. So it's as if somebody would mine a meteorite and use that as a base material. But there are amalgamations of other elements, and some are the rare earth elements like iridium and americanium. And we found in one there was one single isotope of uranium, which by and all the standards of academic knowledge, it can't exist by itself, but in this particular object that it did. The next thing we find that there's carbon nanotechnology, which is represented in so far a large number of these objects, and we go back to look at the older ones, and because of the new technology that's available, we're able to find carbon nanostructures in those too. Now, carbon nanostructures are the strongest material known to man. They've been now used in aircraft design, aerospace design, and so on. There's talk about building a space tower that's a mile high, or a space elevator where you could launch a vehicle from, therefore save lots of money and the cost of fuel, because you don't have to defeat the amount of gravity that launching an object from above the Earth. Japan is working with them now, trying to weave them into a fiber that they can make clothing out of them that would keep the person warm in the winter and cool in the summer, or a lady could change the style or pattern of the garment that she was wearing. They have great applications, and they're used in science. Now, they do not occur in nature. They have to be made. Some are, now let's say, what is a carbon nanotube? This is a one atom of carbon piled on another atom, and then they form a cylinder, which makes a tube. So that's a CNT, is what they call them, carbon nanotubes. Now, if you put a bunch of these together, then you can make a carbon nanofiber. Let's look at that as just a plain wire with no surrounding sheath or insulation around it. Now you can take these wires, let's say, and wrap them together very tightly, so you wind up with a carbon nano strand, and then you can wind the strands around, and you wind up with a carbon nano bundle. They're all there, and then they disperse themselves into crystals, which are made of sodium chloride, but which is common ordinary table salt, so to speak. But the crystals of common ordinary tablespoon salt are random. They can be any shape. These are all rectangular, and they're of different thicknesses and specific shapes. And we know from the early days of radio, for those old bucks like me, the first radio was a crystal set, which you got a crystal and a battery and a copper coil and a set of earphones, and you got yourself a radio station. So there's crystals, crystals or crystallography involved in something which is microscopic. you talk about the objects that we put in dogs or pets today with a little round dot that can be injected through a syringe. This would be like comparing that dot from the battleship to looking at the head of a pin. So these are extremely small, and they use atomic structures to perform electronic functions. We also find things that we don't know what they are, such as balls that are made of gold. We find elongated objects made of various rare metals, metal earths. And of course, we find the most telltale thing, which is non-terrestrial isotopic ratios. And again, a simple explanation of that is we all know what U-235 is. Uranium-235 is what we like to make bombs out of. Well, that's one isotope of the element uranium, and the number has to do with the number of protons and neutrons that are in the nucleus of the atom. So when you mine uranium anywhere on Earth, you're going to mine uranium in which the isotopic ratios of 235, 236, 234, for example, are relatively the same, with varying maybe about 2%. But if you mine uranium and it came from Mars or from an asteroid or from the moon or somewhere else, and you know what it is, then you can say, oh, it came from Mars. Just like we NASA found with the meteorite with carbonaceous life. How did they know it came from Mars? Because we knew what some of the elements were and the isotopic ratios. So we find non-terrestrial isotopic ratios in these objects. So basically that, and we have to align function, most of these are emitting radio waves that are in the FM band, a certain number of kilohertz and megahertz. And because I was able to obtain a data, let's put it that way, from unknown sources, we were able to determine that these were deep space, fixed or mobile frequencies. Now that presents, George, quite a conundrum, because what advanced civilization would be operating with a radio wave? That's absolutely utter nonsense. So there's only two possible explanations. Either somebody here is listening on the phone line, like a party line, using radio waves within our own spectrum, or we're not really finding radio waves at all. We're looking at advanced technology such as scalar waves, which travel much faster than the speed of light, and then when it hits our electromagnetic spectrum, we get what's called a harmonic, and so we read them as the radio wave. The other thing is that the organic coating that surrounds the object prevents the body from rejection or any type of inflammation. There's nothing that we make that's a commercial project, black budget or otherwise, that we have been able to learn that it causes the body not to react to the object itself. But in all these cases, there's no reaction. There's no shift of hormones to the area. There's no inflammatory process. And I might add that in all of them, there are no areas where there's an evident portal of entry. They can't be seen.
Wow. Let's take a couple of calls. There's some folks that are dying to talk to you. West of the Rockies, John in Washington. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I had a friend that was an astronaut, and he told me something that was very interesting. When the first Apollo spacecraft went around the backside of the moon, they made radio contact with somebody on the backside, and he said it was Ashtar Command that did this, and they have these huge spaceships on the backside of the moon that are bigger than the Hindenburg or anything else, and one of those spaceships tried to commandeer a KAL-747 up in Alaska one time, but he got so close to the ground they couldn't come down close to him because because they were so large. And the code word that they used when they came out from the backside of the moon was, there is a Santa Claus. I think that you probably remember that it happened during Christmas time or something. And it was very interesting to hear him talk about some of the things that they have. There's a huge, big base on the backside of the moon. And I also, during my early years as a flight engineer in the Air Force, I was out on a summer camp flight for 2 months to Hawaii. And we used to play golf with this engineer that was retired. Retired engineers were allowed to join the reserves and sacrifice one day of retirement for one day of active duty pay. And we used to go out and play nine holes of golf and then have a few brewskis, and we'd sit and talk. And he was the flight engineer on the Columbine 1 and the Columbine 2. He was the Air Force 1 flight engineer during the Eisenhower administration. And he'd tell me about some of the things that Eisenhower would talk about. And Eisenhower was a licensed aircraft pilot, but he never flew by himself because he had a heart condition. And they'd go up to Edwards Air Force Base once in a while when he'd come out to play golf at Palm Springs. And he would visit the aliens out there, and he told me about all the... Most of the stuff I read later on in that book, Behold a Pale Rider.
Hey, John, we're going to take a break here in about a minute. If you've got a question for Roger, you better jump to it. Interesting stuff, but if you got a question, you better go to it.
Well, I really don't have a question for him. He's very interesting to listen to. My daughter's boyfriend has got an implant in him that's in his thigh. And he says that he's been abducted. No, I don't know. But
well, if he can verify this and get me an X-ray showing its location and so on, and that it's there, I'd be very happy to contact him. So you can get me through my email, which is Lear, L-E-I-R, private, LearPrivate@AOL.com. Anytime, I'd be happy to talk to him.
Yeah, John, by all means, yeah, get in touch with Roger. Yeah, that sounds like an interesting case for you. Tell me this, Roger, I saw on your website, it seemed to me that there was a reference to stud finders. Is that some low-tech way that people can scan their own bodies to see if there's something in there?
Yes, George, absolutely. Any kind of a stud finder. Of course, it's getting harder to find the old ones with a little magnetic thing in that flick back and forth, but I have one in my kit that I use, and what it does, you push the button, and as you get closer to a metallic object, a triangular line begins to form, and when the point of the triangle is finally on the object, it beeps. So you can tell whether you have a metallic object in your body very simply with a stud finder. It doesn't tell you what it is. You know, some people step on things all the time or get things in their body. But it'll tell if it's certainly metallic.
Do you weed out the cases? You say, I'm not going to do the surgery unless they have some sort of a conscious memory or of an abduction or a missing time experience.
Yeah, you're right on. We get so many requests. I run about 3,000 emails a week behind. I can't answer everybody, so we have to weed things out. We get about maybe 10%. Of everything that I get that's a suspected implant, and then only about 1% of the 10% might be a case that we're interested in. And we had to set up a very strict set of criteria and protocols in order to do these scientific studies. So,
I'll ask you what those are when we come back. We're going to take a break here. Dr. Roger Lear is our guest. A lot of folks on the phone lines, and we'll get to as many of your calls as we can. We're talking with Dr. Roger Lear about alien implants and other matters. We'll be going to the phone lines and get to as many of your calls and questions as we can right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Our guest, Dr. Roger Lear, is ready to take your calls and questions east of the Rockies. Jeff, somewhere near Cleveland. Hi, Jeff. Good morning.
How you doing?
Okay.
It's good. Hey, you know something? I've had enough happen to me in my life that I need some answers. Anyway, when I was 13 years old, my father, mother, my sister, and I saw a UFO, and it was massive. Had a light in it, a light in the bottom. You could see the outline for the door. It was just fantastic. Since then, nothing's ever happened to any of them, only me. For example, I mean, I don't know where to go with this. I went to a UFO meeting in Parma, Cleveland, back in 86. The guy's name was Earl Neff, and leading it. Anyway, afterwards, it was just a small group of people, like maybe 20 people. Afterwards, we went to a restaurant, and they had coffee pie or whatever. And these people asked me what my name was. I told you, introduced myself. Well, we want to know your last name. Well, when I told them, they all talked to each other in a football huddle-like type and weren't talking to me. And afterwards, they sat down, and this woman said to me, "You will always be watched and protected." Fine. I said, "God's watching us all." "Well, not God." I said, "Well, who?" She says, "Well, we can't tell you." "All right. Well, why?" She says, "It's not time. When it's time, we will tell you. Until then, we can't." That was the odd part. The really worst part was, after that, they would have nothing to do with me whatsoever. It's like I was not in the room. It's like I was not there.
Well, Jeff, you're talking about the reactions of a UFO group. Did you have any other sort of paranormal or unexplained type encounters?
Yeah, too many. Okay, listen, in 80, I drive semi for a living. I was on Pima, Arizona, this is in 2000. I've gone to sleep in the truck, probably about 8 o'clock at night. I woke up about 4 in the morning. I didn't feel right. My head burned. I had a spot on my forehead that hurt. So I went inside, I looked, and there was a mark on my forehead. A red circle with the size of a quarter. Had four dots, two towards the top on the outside and two at the bottom, and one in the center with a hole going in it, in my forehead. All right. Well, I left. Well, I drove about 400 miles, and I stopped at a truck stop, went and looked, and it was gone. 2 years ago, I was watching TV one night on crop circles. An exact same design crop circle was this mark that was on my forehead.
Jeff, I'll tell you what, interesting similarity, what you're describing. Do you have a question for Dr. Lear about implants? Do you have anything like that?
Well, yeah. Well, you know something, right now, back of my head. In 09, I had a cyst, whatever, in the back of my head. I still got the lump, and I dug out. I thought it was like maybe a wart or something. I don't know. I still got the hole there. I got a hard piece of metal. I don't know what it was, and I threw it away. That was in 09. And that's bothered me since. I get all these questions and nobody to talk to.
Well, hold on just a second. Roger, have you ever heard of the implants being in somebody's head?
Well, yeah, we have taken one of them out from the back of the head area. One of the things we find in common with the implant surgeries is the objects are usually located fairly superficial, but a very close relationship to bone. And, of course, the skull, you know, doesn't have much meat around it. So it's a possibility that he had something there. It's just so unfortunate when I hear people, you know, get these kind of things, and they have there's a built-in instinct not to produce physical evidence, so they do throw them away.
I was always told, keep my mouth shut, don't talk, don't get yourself in Dutch. Anyway, I mean, just like the mark on my forehead. And I've seen that crop circle. Can you relate to that? Anything on and any statement on that?
Thanks for the call, Jeff. We'll appreciate the call. We'll let Roger answer that.
Yeah, we have seen marks on abductees' bodies that don't appear in a dermatology book. One of them, of course, is the famous scoop mark. The other are some dots, which are in particular geometric forms such as triangles, rectangles, and so on. I have seen something that has looked like one of the crop circles. Another thing, we use ultraviolet light to examine the patient before we ever do any surgery. And on one of the last cases, we found by using three different frequencies of ultraviolet light that he had a chevron which measured about 2.5 inches up and down on the arm by maybe an inch and a half across. and he didn't know it was there. Never knew it was there. We found it with the ultraviolet light, and it was, you know, a symbol of something, but you couldn't see it without the ultraviolet. So a lot of these things do occur. David Jacobs, of course, says anybody that's had a prolonged sighting of a UFO is a good, you know, candidate to become an abductee.
First-time caller, Robert in West Virginia. Good morning, Robert, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Good morning, George. How are you?
Okay.
All right. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff I would love to ask Dr. Lear. You know, starting with, I'm curious, I mean, because it is an amazing claim. I'm curious, has any kind of government agency contacted him, you know, trying to feed him information or misinformation or something like that to cover this up at all?
In short, no. I've worked in laboratories. We brought materials in. One was a black budget laboratory, and I was the last case to get any civilian, any material in there, and then it became totally black. I'm working with another company now who about 20% of their projects are black, and they told me that the majority of their income is commercial enterprises, but they do have a certain amount of projects they do for the federal government. But the commercial projects that they do are so far in advance that they say, you know, don't bring us a project that's 10 years in the future. Don't bring us a project that's 100 years in the future. Bring us a project of 1,000 years in the future, and we'll look at your data. And if we like it, you know, we'll pay for you to work there, do your research, we'll look at the data, and if you haven't reached a satisfactory conclusion in 6 months, we'll continue to fund you. You might be there for several years, but then they have a whole marketing program where they market this stuff. So there's a tremendous amount of research, advanced research, both commercial and black budget, that's gone out there. And, you know, George, the average scuttlebutt on the figure, combined figure of the black budget now is $63 trillion, which is not accountable to the AGO.
They've got more money than we do. Go ahead, Robert.
Oh, I'm sorry. Would you say that what is your evidence really that this has anything to do with aliens and not maybe some kind of you know, experimental research program? Why aliens?
Well, I'll give you a classic example. Going away totally from the amount of data that I just presented showing non-terrestriality and the nano-isotopic arrangements of a complex nanotechnological radio frequency-producing object. Let's just go away from that. In a black budget laboratory where I was at one time, there was a number of scientists that were crowded into the room. They almost shoved me out in the hall. Now, when I was there, the laboratory director was standing there with a hand on each hip, and these scientists were so engrossed in the material that I brought in. The director, of course, was not very happy because these guys are on a government payroll. So if they don't know the stuff that I'm bringing in and looking at, it's pretty safe to say that this is advanced beyond our technology, even for the secret stuff. And they say that black budget technology could be 100 years in advance of academic science that we already know. So it's a pretty good indication.
Don't you think that the Pentagon maybe, or you know, some other kind of military project has technology far more advanced than is available to the public, say? And so I would, instead of aliens, I would jump to, you know, what are these tracking devices, who's trying to track humanity, you know, and does it have something to do with aliens, like you say, or does it have something to do with, you know, maybe some kind of government program or something like that?
We got your point, Robert. Thank you. We appreciate the calls, and that's very questions. That's very fair questions. I think Roger has answered it somewhat, but Roger, do you want to take another stab at it?
Yeah, let me answer his question, and this is about as good as I can get. Number one, they are, I can categorically say they are not tracking devices. We know with human technology that our DNA for every living creature has an electronic signature. So it doesn't take that much science to build a receiver that they could track, or we could track anybody in the world. So, you know, those folks out there are so afraid of being tagged with chips. Don't worry about it, folks, because as soon as the technology is developed for tracking DNA, they can get you anywhere they want. So no advanced race is going to use an object to track somebody. And what I believe that they are used for is because there's an experimentation going on with the human race, and I think that's the key factor of the abduction program. We know that the majority of all abductees talk about the taking of ova and sperm. Well, these are not guys from the cooking channel, for heaven's sakes. They're not there making omelets. You know, they're doing genetic experiments, and something is going on with the human race, and I think it's very well predominantly apparent in children. Children are not the same human beings. I don't know, George, if you remember John White from Connecticut.
Yes.
But years ago, he coined the term Homo noeticus, and that the human race was changing. He was right on. These kids today can do things without learning it in a book or hearing it on TV or on the radio. They already know it.
Yeah, they embarrass me on a regular basis. Robert, good questions. Appreciate the call. Christian in Los Angeles, been holding for a while. Good morning, Christian.
Hello. First of all, Roger Lear, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I wanted to compliment you. I think you're just as, the work you do is just as important as the late Bud Hopkins. Congratulations. Keep it up. I wanted to add also quickly that I always thought they were, I was always under the assumption that they were some form of a tracking device, because look at the way animal biologists, we, you know, keep track of, let's say, coyotes or you know, dolphins or whatnot. That's an interesting thing that you kind of put, because so many alien abductees say that they've been abducted for years. And let's say they may move from one location, let's say halfway or across the country to another part of the country, and they're followed. So I was under the assumption they were probably some form of a tracking device. And also, before the show ends, can you also run up your email? So if I have any other questions for you, because I'm going to read your book soon, Aliens and the Scalpel, which I think is your first one.
Yes,
and keep up the good work.
Thank
you very much, sir. Bye-bye.
Thank you for your compliments. First of all, I'll give you my email again. It's Lear, L-E-I-R, private, like a private in the Army, LearPrivate@AOL.com. In reference to back to the tracking question again, as I stated, we're dealing with the civilizations now. Dr. Robert Kuntz made some calculations based on the isotopic decay that we find in these objects. I didn't want to go into this because it involves a lot of mathematics. And his calculations are dated back to the age of the Big Bang, and how far one isotope, or how long it takes before it's degraded into another isotope, or one element can go from barium to beryllium or something like that. But he says that these probably come from one-third away across the Milky Way galaxy, and that the civilization that's using this stuff is at least a million years older than we are. So, in that statement alone, how could we ever be so egotistical to think that with our state of development, human logic has anything to do with the logic of an advanced race thousands or millions of years older? So to make a comparison of what we do with bears and animals and so on, it really isn't going to hold water. We don't even know if they landed on the White House lawn, if we could communicate with them. They would have to lower themselves to our level for even communication.
Try to get one more quick call in. Kevin in Houston, you better make this fast. Oh, Kevin is gone. Morgan in Seattle and west of the Rockies. Quick question, Morgan.
Oh, yep. Boy, yes. First of all, I'm in the 50s, actually just 50 years old. And talking or hearing these other guys, I have had an innate knowledge of this stuff after hearing the last two callers, an innate knowledge of this since I was really young. But that's not the reason I called in. I wanted to know if connected as you are in the middle ground and the sightings of all different kinds of different species and different reports from abductees of different looking and formation, you know, physical formation. Have you guys had any knowledge passed on to you regarding that? And us being in some sort of middle ground or protected, as I think I've heard earlier spoke of.
Okay, Morgan, I have to cut you off there because we're running out of time. Roger, you want to tackle that very quickly?
Very quickly, yes. I think somebody is responsible for us. If the situation was reversed, we wouldn't be having the conversation because we wouldn't be here. Somebody is responsible for us from the beginning. And we don't know the history of our human race. It's been kept a secret, and most people don't delve into the hidden knowledge of the ancients. Not everyone is a George Maxwell. But if we learned enough about what happened in the past, we might understand what's happening in the present and then have some understanding of the future. We don't have it, but yes, in a way, I think we are protected.
Roger, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Good luck at the citizens' hearing, and good luck also with the programs you're doing there at CIRO. And I hope you'll come back and talk to us when your new book comes out.
Well, I sure will, George, and I appreciate you having me on. And for 15 cents a day, I don't see how anybody can go wrong by getting me signing up for the information that's so vital.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it. We'll talk to you again soon. I also want to thank my earlier guest, Robert Bigelow. There's a lot of information in there, folks. Some of that you might have to read between the lines, but there was some good info in there. Thanks to my friends there at Coast, Jeff and Gina, Webmaster Lex and Dan Galante. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. Good night, everyone.